Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. So whether you're tuning in live or catching up later, stay ahead with four stories that really count. Coming up on the program, illicit trade is still thriving as South Africa fights to fix its economy. Trade wars hit advertising budgets as global brands begin to pull back. A court ruling halts an AXA takeover in an airport screening showdown, and why Johannesburg is the next big bet in property investment. It's Wednesday, the 7th of May. Now, illicit trade is costing South Africa billions in lost revenue, jobs and investment, and yet the problem persists, even as enforcement agencies try to fight back. Now, there's a new report out from the Transnational Alliance to Combat Illicit Trade, and it suggests that it's time for a national reset. It's proposing a bold public-private partnership to get there. But my question is this possibly the breakthrough that we need as far as the problem is concerned, or maybe just another well-meaning report and suggestion? I'm going to talk to the director of the Alliance now, Esteban Giudici. Esteban, a very warm welcome. And let me start with this very bluntly. Why, after years of reports and pledges, do you think is this country still failing to dent the scale of illicit trade?
It's true. It has been years of reports, but this is not a problem only for South Africa. We believe that many countries are grappling with this situation. Of course, there are many factors that bring countries to have these kind of problems, in the sense that there is a kind, if you want, a gridlock. It's difficult to move forward. And something that we need to realize is that criminals have leverage on technology, and in many different ways of using advanced techniques to commit their crimes. And the authorities and the private sector too, we haven't caught up yet, in the sense that there are many things that we can do that we are not yet doing. Yes, we have the reports that showcase what's the situation. We have the second iteration of our report in South Africa that was released yesterday at the Business Unity of South Africa. It demonstrates the big amount of tax loss that the country is suffering, but this is just to start the discussion. The point here, as you mentioned in the introduction, is that we are proposing a bold private-public partnership. And why we are doing that? Because we believe that this a momentum that we have, there is a political momentum, a political will, and there is also the technology here. And we need to start doing this. And yesterday, with the stakeholders of at BUSA, and this week, while talking with authorities here in South Africa, we are proposing to first host a public-private meeting, which is going to include SARS authorities, many other countries in the region, because it's important. This is a transnational problem that needs to have all key stakeholders in the region, including brands, service providers. And the second step that we are proposing is implementing a technology-based platform that is going to put all stakeholders together, because exchange of information is key, and that's exactly what we are failing. We are not doing it in an efficient way.
So I would then ask you why it's become so necessary for the private sector to step in where the public sector has underperformed.
This is a very good question. I don't want to put it like the public sector has underperformed. I like to see it in a way that this is the evolution that we have had. For many years, we had multilateralism and organizations that were supposed to help with this, but it's becoming completely difficult because of the geopolitical situation. And I believe that the private sector, because of its reactivity, its resources, its know-how and technology, it can provide very specific solutions. The one that I just mentioned a minute ago, it's something that is purely technical. Private sector is the only one that can inject that right away, and we need this to happen soon.
The danger, of course, is that any partnership like this becomes a talk shop or bureaucratic overlay. It's got to move quickly beyond that, hasn't it?
That's exactly the idea. We don't believe that this is going to be the case. It's important to have discussions at a technical level. It's not going to become a talk show. Where we go, the places we go, we try to make it smoothly, hear everyone, but we always come with concrete next steps. And this is what we are doing here. We already have dates for the working groups, and we're inviting all the relevant stakeholders so we can move fast with this, because the tools are here, the political momentum is here, and we need to make this happen. And trust me, I hope that soon we are going to report again to show you that it's not a talk show, but we are going to have concrete results. We need to catch up.
What do you believe would be the immediate priorities? And I do understand you're still in the planning phase, but there is urgency here, given that your report calls illicit trade deeply entrenched.
I think that there are already immediate actions that can be taken. In particular, I would like to focus in the sector of products subject to excise tax here in South Africa. This is something that happened out of the pandemic. You may remember the restriction laws, particularly in alcohol and tobacco. Because of these restriction laws, we are still suffering this problem of illicit trade of 60% in tobacco and around 18% in alcohol. This compounded with corruption at many different levels, it's creating very fertile ground for organized criminality. And there are simple ways to start tackling this problem. We are discussing these ones and we are proposing this one. For instance, it's going to be important to rationalize the different schemes of, let's say, tax or the way that products are made affordable for the consumer. Because when it's difficult for the consumer to afford legitimate products, this is fertile ground for illicit trade.
And
this is something that can be done quite fast.
And part of that problem in terms of affordability is that inflation and unemployment fuel illicit trade. And the situation, particularly as far as South Africa is concerned, is that it's not getting any better.
That's correct. Well, we have seen that inflation has curbed 3%, which is something positive. You are completely right. We showcase that in our reports where there is inflation and low credit ratings. There is more illicit trade in general, but this is a negative cycle that we need to reverse. If we start fighting against illicit trade, the tax collection is going to be greater and that money can go to the sectors that need it the most, and the economic prospects, therefore, are going to be better.
It's also about making sure that this is all properly led, that there's not a rivalry that exists within the framework. And in that respect, you're recommending appointing an interagency coordinator. What exactly is that? What does it entail? And I'd also suggest to you that South Africa has tried coordinators in the past with limited success.
Yeah, that's correct. This is a general recommendation. It has two aspects. The first one, it means that you are prioritizing the fight against illicit trade if you appoint a coordinator. But the way we see it is that this coordinator should be attached. I mean, our suggestion is that should work together with the new solutions that we are proposing. It would be like a sort of focal point maybe for this platform that we are discussing. I mean, it's important to have someone who has the possibility of interacting with the different agencies that one country has, because illicit trade is not a problem that should be only addressed from law enforcement. It should also include other ministries and departments of the government that range from health department, financial departments, and all these kind of things. And that's why we talk about having and appointing a coordinator.
And just a quick one in conclusion, how are you going to measure whether this proposed partnership actually makes a dent in illicit trade?
I think that this is going to be low-hanging fruit. If this happens the way that we are proposing this and we have authorities cooperating, the results are going to be natural. They are going to come along the way. If we have more cooperation between authorities and private sector, and here I'm talking about brown owners and service providers, because there is a lot to be done. The first steps, they are going to ripe good results right away. I can tell you that. It's just a matter of start working on these specific recommendations.
Well, we'll be following all of this with a great deal of interest. Esteban Giudici, thank you very much indeed. Director of the Transnational Alliance to Combat Illicit Trade.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, global advertising spend is still growing, but don't let the headline fool you. The World Advertising Research Center's latest forecast has cut nearly $20 billion from expectations. That is serious. Trade wars, inflation, and regulation are shaking the foundation of the world's biggest ad markets, from tech to retail, all the way through to automotive. So, where does the industry go from here, and can brands still afford to build in a fragmented global economy? I'm in conversation now with Alex Brownsell, head of content at the center. Alex, a very warm welcome to you. So the headline is a $20 billion downgrade. How bad is that really, and what is behind the cut, do you think?
First of all, to put into context, the global advertising market is worth more than $1 trillion. So the 20 billion cut is obviously significant, but it's not existential. It's a bit of a blow for a sector that's been on a roll in recent years. You know, last year in particular, we saw the total global market grow by double digits, 11% year on year, which was the, if you discount the sort of oddities of the COVID years, it was the biggest year-on-year increase that we'd seen for 7 or 8 years. So it's been a great run for the advertising industry, and I think what we're seeing now is that we're likely to see that momentum slow.
Do you think it is now pointing towards a structural shift in global advertising, or possibly just a cyclical slowdown?
I think what's been interesting is that over the last few years, I think we have been seeing something of a structural change in terms of the digitization of the advertising market, and spend shifting away from the likes of TV, which has been, up to a certain point was the largest channel by expenditure, towards digital channels, whether that's paid search, social media, other forms of online video. And even within, I suppose, channels like television itself, we're seeing investment flow from linear television, broadcast television, towards connected television and streaming. So there is structural change occurring at the moment. What we think will happen is, as spend slows down, as marketers feel a degree of pressure to prove that their investment is working, we're going to see that kind of pivot towards what we call performance channels, which are those channels that I suppose are slightly more measurable, that slightly in theory deliver a shorter term result.
I'm not surprised that your report cites trade tariffs as a major disruptor. So, in your opinion, then, do you think brands should now be rethinking global campaign models entirely?
There are certain categories where I think that the nature of their campaign planning has to change. I mean, you know, if you're working in technology and suddenly parts are harder to come by at the right costs, automotive, for instance, or even retail, where your margins are being squeezed, I think there's inevitably going to be a degree of rethinking about what marketing will look like over the next 18 months. In general, what we always do advise is that brands do keep topping up the top of that funnel, you know, generating future demand. Advertising isn't just about generating a sale in the here and now. It's about the longer term effects, and all of the research that we've ever carried out and shared really shows that. So what we'd advocate is that marketers don't panic. They don't turn the taps off completely or focus entirely on just living hand to mouth, but that they do sort of keep an eye on the long term. And that is in part because a lot of competitors, as you know, their competitive set may slow down spending, there are opportunities to grow share of voice, there are opportunities to win share of market as well.
I'm interested to read that retailers were pulling back. Do you think it's purely about cost, or do you think maybe consumer brands are becoming a little more cynical, maybe losing a bit of confidence in the return on investment when it comes to digital advertising?
I'm not sure that I would fully agree that there's skepticism about the effectiveness of advertising. I think that what happens is within a lot of businesses, you know, marketing is a discretionary cost, and if the business is feeling a little nervousness, if confidence is low, it's one of the first parts of the budget to be cut. That's something that we've seen in previous recessionary cycles. And, you know, I suspect that that's something that's happening at the moment, particularly while retailers, as they're trying to figure out where their supply chain are going and how they're going to be able to move forward. You know, in the case of certain categories, you know, maybe not so much retail, but automotive, there's a question of, can I advertise this product? Will I be able to deliver this? over the next kind of 6 to 12 months. So I don't think marketers are questioning the effectiveness of the advertising platforms and channels per se, but I think there's a confidence issue.
I'm glad you raised automotive ad spend down nearly 7%. That is a worry.
It is. And I think it's a change from what we've seen recently, where automotive had, I think, regained a degree of confidence as an industry, as we've seen, you know, electric cars, electric vehicle models reaching the market and sales increasing. So this is going to be a challenging time. And obviously, one of the big changes to that market that we've seen in the last couple of years is the rise of Chinese car manufacturers and you know, brands like BYD. So they had been one of the sort of, you know, factors in the increasing spend we've seen. So obviously, as they are questioning their ability to serve a market like the US, inevitably they are going to pull all advertising spend, as we've seen with some of the sort of e-commerce brands from China as well, like Temu.
And Alex, just very quickly, you spoke about the industry not facing an existential crisis, but let me ask you an existential question. We know that AI is transforming content creation. Do you think we've got to the point now where we need a new definition of what actually counts as media?
It's a fair question, and I think it's something that the whole industry is wrestling with at the moment. You know, we're seeing a lot of disruption and change within the advertising agency world, for instance, and the big holding companies are reassessing what they do and how they service their clients. Because I think if you listen to Mark Zuckerberg, his vision of the future of advertising is that you basically just tell Meta what you want. And they do everything. They will place your ads, they will create the content, they will tell you how it performed, and they'll give you the measurement. So we are, I think, if not exactly in an existential moment, I think we are in a period of the most rapid change of the advertising world that I've known in my career. And I think you probably have to go back to sort of the kind of introduction of the internet to a time where we've seen so much change and likely to see so much more over the next few years.
Appreciate your time today. That's Alex Brownsell from the World Advertising Research Center, Head of Content. Thank you.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, it's a legal battle, I think, with big implications for every air traveler in this country. This week, the Gauteng High Court dismissing an appeal by Airports Company South Africa and the Civil Aviation Authority, clearing the way for Aviation Coordinating or Coordination Services, let's call it ACS, to urgently replace critical baggage screening equipment at OR Tambo and King Shaka airports. But behind all of this legal language, and I'm going to try and simplify that for you, I think is a deeper fight about who really runs key parts of our airport infrastructure. I'm in conversation now with the Chief Executive Officer of ACS, Duke Patla. Duke, a very warm welcome. Maybe just walk us through very simply what the High Court ruled and maybe more importantly, why it matters.
The Gauteng High Court dismissed an urgent appeal brought by AXA and SACA, confirming that ACS is allowed to go ahead with the urgent replacement of age-hold baggage screening equipment at both OR Tambo and King Shaka Airport. This is significant because as the current inline systems are at the end of their useful lives and spare components are no longer readily available, and this was confirmed by the original equipment manufacturer who basically gives us maintenance over these units. So over the past 5 years, AXA has not permitted ACS to replace age screening equipment at OR Tambo and King Shaka Airport. And this has left airports reliant on outdated systems, raising the risk of operational failures and delays. Should HBS screening equipment fail, these airports would have to augment screening procedures at level 3, which include sniffer dogs, explosive trace detection, and manual hand screening, which would obviously be significantly slower and delay the processing of hold baggage screening.
And cause huge frustration. As far as hold baggage screening is concerned, are there security risks associated with the outdated equipment that you've referenced?
Look, in that, obviously, Jeremy, there are newer threats in the market. And with there being newer threats in the market, you can imagine if you're using outdated equipment, which only has been designed to detect the old methodology or method of making explosives, which is obviously military, you know, types of explosives. And clearly, obviously, it will basically put you at risk for not being able to detect and newer types of threats. But however, if this equipment is not serviceable, what it does, it will simply, you know, delay the processing of hold baggage screening at airports, resulting in delayed operations and delayed flights.
Why is ACS and not AXA legally responsible for managing this function?
Well, if you look at the South African aviation laws, places the responsibility of hold baggage screening on the operator. So the operator, as per our interpretation of CATS and CAS, which are, you know, civil aviation technical standards as well as civil aviation regulation standards, the operator is the airline and not the aerodrome license holder. So again, if you look at why ACS was established, it was established by the airlines to basically fulfill this mandate. And ACS has been doing this effectively for the last 20 years. So we operate on behalf of the airlines and we take the profits and plow them back into the industry. So the services is funded by the airlines and awarded through the competitive and transparent procurement process. So our model ensures efficiency, compliance, and public accountability, which is why it has consistently delivered safe world-class results.
If I understand this correctly, and if I've read the ruling right, my understanding is that AXA tried to insource this service. Was the move about control? Was it about cost? Or do you think something entirely different?
Well, it was really about control from what we understand, because if you look at it from a cost point of view, Jeremy, when ACS was established back in 1999, we charged 10 rands for hold baggage screening per passenger, a departing passenger. And if you look at what that cost is today, it's only 19 rands. So there is nobody that can do this in a more cost-effective manner than ACS is, because we get into trouble with the airlines if we make a whole lot of profits. And hence, earlier submitted that we plow the profits back into the industry to invest in latest available technology.
Is it fair to say that ACS's relationship with AXA now is tricky, maybe even tenuous?
It's tricky, but what it does is it creates an opportunity to really go back to basics and then, you know, build a good relationship, because at the end of the day, it's about the service that we deliver to the airline passengers as well as the airlines.
So the ruling gives you temporary relief, but the bigger review case is still pending again, if I've read this correctly. Are you confident about the eventual outcome?
We are confident because we strongly believe that it is the responsibility based on the CATS and CAS interpretation that it is the airlines that are responsible to basically run with us. And we do hope that, however, we could, before we even have the courts reviewing as to who's the responsible person or the responsible entity that should be running with these processes, we hope that we can sit and, you know, get a mediation of some sort with AXA so that we can eventually resolve this in an amicable way, which will be a win-win for everybody concerned.
Would you agree with me that this is almost in many respects a test case, that it sends out some sort of message about the balance of power between airport operators and aviation service providers in the country?
That is correct. I mean, Jeremy, if you look at the airline industry, it's a tight-knit industry, and you can't rely on just one service provider. You basically have to have a web of community with that's made up of subject matter experts that will basically do what they're supposed to do to assist in having an efficient operation of the airline industry.
Thank you very much indeed. The Chief Executive Officer of ACS, that's Aviation Coordination Services, Duke Patla, I appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, after years of sluggish growth, Johannesburg's property market may finally be turning a corner. A new report from the Lansdowne Property Group is suggesting the city has hit the bottom of a cycle, offering smart buyers an entry point at 2007 price levels. Wow. with some of the best rental yields in the country as well. But is this really a recovery, or is this maybe just some clever marketing spin here? I want to discuss that further with Jonathan Kohler, who's Chief Executive Officer of the Lansdowne Property Group. Jonathan, a very warm welcome. So let me dive straight in here. This sounds very good, but let's be frank. What's the real evidence that the market has hit the bottom? Maybe it's just flatlining.
Yeah, no, I hear you, Jeremy. I think for us, you know, we definitely seeing sort of increased interest in the market at the moment. You know, I mean, our agents nationally, specifically in Joburg, you know, there's a lot more inquiries on residential properties. People are actually starting to pull the trigger. You know, I think there's a lot of value in the Johannesburg property market at the moment. You know, if I compare it to Cape Town, you know, I think a lot of savvy Johannesburg buyers who are deciding between, you know, moving to Cape Town and investing there or investing in Johannesburg have seen that the Cape Town property prices are really, really expensive, and they're seeing a lot of value in the Johannesburg market. You know, so I think that they're pulling the trigger on the Johannesburg property and sort of choosing a much larger freestanding home, whereas in Cape Town it literally costs three times the value.
But you've got to offset that, surely, if it is a buyer's market, as you're suggesting, but you've got to offset that against the poor infrastructure and ongoing safety concerns. And that is a consideration.
100%. Jeremy, if I look at myself, you know, I mean, I've owned my business for 18 years now, and I've been renting for years and years and years, and I live in Johannesburg. And recently we did the exercise with my wife. We were considering moving to Cape Town, and we went down and we had a look at properties there. And although, yeah, the infrastructure in Cape Town, you know, is good, and there were magnificent properties there, the purchase price, I just didn't feel comfortable with spending the amount of money on Cape Town properties. And generally where the value is in the Johannesburg property market is in sort of secure residential estates for that exact reason. You know, having a look at, let's say, your Stain Cities, for example, where inside the infrastructure is really, really good, the security is excellent, but you're still paying a hefty premium, where we actually made the decision to purchase a freestanding home, you know, just because the value, literally we paid what the purchasers paid for the property in 2007. You literally can't build it for the same price, you know. So I think if you sort of hedge, you know, the type of freestanding home that you buy in terms of the location, you know, is it in a boomed off area? You know, is there good security, et cetera, et cetera? You can get a lot of value.
Are you confident, as far as Joburg prices are concerned, that this just isn't a temporary plateau before prices drop even further?
I don't think so. I think I'm fairly confident. I mean, I think, you know, the people who are going to go and semigrate to Cape Town or move down to KZN or move internationally, I think that those people have gone. And I think that the people who are still in Johannesburg now are in Johannesburg to stay. And I think that that will drive the market, you know. And I think that when, you know, I think people are sort of more accepting in Johannesburg as to what is going on. You know, hopefully, I mean, we're going to need some, we're going to need some proper momentum from the GMU, not just sentiment. You know, we're going to need some proper infrastructure change. But, you know, I think that most people still work in Gauteng, and it will drive the property prices, in my opinion.
And Jonathan, I'm interested to see you reference 2007 prices, but let me come back at you and say, is that not just a reflection of a market that hasn't created any real wealth in over two decades?
Yeah, you know, I think it's, I think sort of 2007 prices, you know, why I say that, you know, I mean, I remember when I was a sales consultant, you know, in one of Johannesburg's leading property developers, you know, and I was in sort of that golden time between 2004 and 2006, you know, where you'd get sort of 25 to 35% capital appreciation per year. And then obviously 2007, it started to slow down. 2008, the financial crisis, I think sort of end of 2009 to 2010, you know, the hype of the World Cup, you know, the Gautrain infrastructure, I think the rand was sort of seven to the US dollar there. And now I feel that, you know, there's a lot of value. There's a lot of property development going on in the Gauteng area, and I think it will drive the property prices up. You know, I think we've also seen some of our clients who have sort of moved down to Cape Town realize that it's not, you know, it's not just all great weather and excellent jobs opportunity, and have come back to Joburg, you know, because they're actually the standard of living that they have here in terms of what they earn and in terms of where they live is actually greater than Cape Town, even though Cape Town might be a better environment to live in.
And that's a very compelling argument, Jonathan, but let's come back to prices. So let's take a place like Four Ways, for instance. A lot of development, obviously a lot cheaper than Cape Town, but some would say that affordability doesn't necessarily equal investment-grade quality over the long term.
Sure. Yeah, you know, so that's sort of like the risk that you have to take. You know, I mean, if we have a look at, you know, I mean, if we have a look at one of the old SummerCon apartments, let's say in Johannesburg, you know, I mean, you know, those units, you're probably seeing a one bedroom ground floor unit at the moment, you know, that you could pick up for about 680,000, where you could get between 6,800 and 7,300 rand rental per month, you know, so the yield is extremely attractive. You know, but the question that you're asking is, are you going to get capital appreciation from the 680,000? As long as there's developers in the northern suburbs of Joburg, which there will always be, people are launching developments and they're building at new land rezoned price and new build cost. And new build cost is getting more and more expensive. So I really feel that you will get the capital appreciation, and with very, very attractive yields, you sort of have to assume that you're going to get some reasonable capital appreciation going forward, you know. But if you're getting sort of a 10% net rental yield in Johannesburg, it's still an extremely attractive rental yield. And if you're a first-time homeowner and you're taking out finance for that, it can cover the bond and most of the levies, you know. So it's a good sort of entry level into the market.
Jonathan, are there notable suburbs in and around Johannesburg that are showing real traction? And if so, is this sustainable?
Yeah, you know, I mean, you have to have a look at up and coming areas. You know, I mean, we, you know, when we're having a look at areas like Limbro Park, for example, you know, that and sort of that Greenstone sort of area where previously people wouldn't sort of think that Limbro Park, for example, is close to Sandton, but it's very close to Sandton. I mean, it's closer to Sandton to actually travel than it is from Four Ways, for example. You know, so I think that, looking at areas like that, you know, I mean, I think that you would get really good, or you've got more likelihood of getting capital appreciation in a sort of up and coming area. I think it's also worth sort of having a look at, you know, where the Gautrain is going to go. Having a look at the Gautrain going to Four Ways, for example. You know, Four Ways, a lot of people don't like Four Ways, you know, but with the infrastructure, you know, with sort of centers like Four Ways Mall, for example, you've got Flanagan and Gerald that have come in there, you know, it's starting to get better yields, infrastructure around, hopefully starting to improve, going all the way up to sort of Stain City, Lion Sands, you know, all of those areas are built up, you know, and they're building up a lot, you know. So I think that, you know, that would increase your likelihood of getting good capital appreciation.
I'm going to leave it there. Jonathan Kohler, thank you very much indeed. Chief Executive Officer of the Lansdowne Property Group. I appreciate your time. And that is MoneyWeb at midday for today. We are live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.